I remember blisters. We try to break boots in and on a route march, that sort of nonsense.
Yeah.
But one other thing about Brandon, one of the managers in the Hudson's Bay Company that I worked for was a Peters. His name was Peters. And he was from the prairies, and he had a brother who was a doctor in Brandon, Dr. Peters. So, of course, he insisted that I touch base with Dr. Peters, and I did. And they were wonderful to me. I literally had a home away from home that whole time that I was in Brandon, which was magnificent because there was nothing to do in Brandon. You got outside of a couple of coffee shops, so it was a dead loss.
Yeah.
So I was able to go and spend hours and hours and hours at the in the evenings with the Peters, at the Peters home, which was wonderful for me. It it made that stay at Brandon much easier than it would have been otherwise.
When you were there, and I'm thinking of the first couple of months, I suppose, did you form any friendships who came into your life later?
No,
none at all.
No, not at all, because we were. You began to form friendships, yes. As a matter of fact, I can't remember names now, but I remember a couple of faces of people that we sort of began to pal around. As a matter of fact, when I talked about going to Peters, I began to take one of these lads particularly with me when we went to Peters. Not knowing what was going to happen, but as it did happen, as soon as drafts started to move out, of course, we all went 10 different directions, and I never saw that person again. I have no idea whatever happened to him, as a matter of fact. So there was no, although we didn't know at the time, we weren't there. We were there long enough to make not any close friendship, but begin to strike up one, which might have gone on if we had managed to stay together.
Yeah.
But again, split up.
Well, how long would be your initial period of training before a decision was reached, either by yourself or your officers, that you were going in one particular area for aircrew?
Oh, no. The decision had been made right from the first medical. I had applied for pilot training, and I had passed all the medicals for pilot training. So I was in the pilot training tube, so to speak.
Yeah.
I was in that pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And I would stay in that pipeline until something, either I failed pilot training or something happened along the way that would cause me to be dropped or diverted into another, one of the other aircrew trades, or grounded.
Well, then let me pose the question another way, Reg. How long were you in basic training before you began to learn something about the basics of flying?
Quite some time. As a matter of fact, a long time. It seemed long in those days, and then when you look back on the months, it wasn't really that long. As I say, we were at ITS, it was either 3 or 4 weeks. Now, the pipeline was so plugged that they had to. I guess, I don't know enough about the planning in those days, but I'm assuming that they had the schools being built, all the flying schools.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there were going to be new schools popping open all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to make sure that there were enough people coming through the pipe
to
be ready to, boom, go out into all these schools when they were opened. So not only were the ITSs jammed, but they had to have something in between the ITS and the beginning of flying training.
Mm-hmm.
As a holding thing. And the method they used was to take people when they'd finished ITS, as I did at Brandon, and shove you out to existing flying stations for guard duty, literally for guard duty, walking the perimeter with a rifle.
Yeah.
And I was sent to Saskatoon. So I was at Saskatoon. I know it was into the winter. I had my 21st birthday on the train going to Victoria, to Vancouver to go to the FTS. So it would be December
40,
anyway. Winter 40-41.
Yeah.
But December, definitely, I was at Saskatoon. And I could remember, we only had just ordinary greatcoats and no winter clothing. And boy, doing guard duty. And by then, the temperature was already dropping down to 20 and 30 below at Saskatoon. And out there, I forget what it was. I think it was 2 hours on and 2 hours off or something like that. Holy Jesus. Frostbite all over the place. It really was. It was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, I guess we didn't know enough about frostbite in those days. There wasn't the right equipment or clothing. And when you went out on guard duty, you put every sweater you had on, you put every piece of clothing you had on, and hope that you would get out, get through without frostbite. And even to the point in those days where some of the drunkards, I can remember at Saskatoon watching, I guess it was a harbor being cranked up, and the pilot waved to one of the ground crew that he wants something, and the ground crew jumped up onto the wing of the airplane to talk to the pilot, jumped down, and of course by that time, literally a matter of, oh, what, 5 seconds? Of course, the wind chill factor, unbelievable, and that boy almost lost his ears. I'd never seen such a mess because I saw him in hospital. And oh, God, the frostbite. The wind chill factor. It must have been about 30 below. So he must have run into a wind chill factor probably of about something like about 1,500 to 2,000, which, of course, is instant freezing. And his ears, I've never seen a man in such a mess as he was. But that's the sort of thing that everybody was learning. There was no warning about wind chill factor, not like we do now. Anybody up in the Arctic now, God, the first thing you're taught before you go up there in the wintertime is wind chill. You must understand wind chill. And it's drilled into you what you do and don't know. Well, those days, hell, we didn't know enough, I suppose, about it.
This place where you were on guard duty, this is one of the new...
This was one of the flying schools. That's right. It was just opened.
Yeah.
Just opened. And I can't remember how many of us there were there in this guard duty platoon, or whatever it was. I can just remember how bloody cold it was. And the great roar when we were told, or at least certainly when I was told, and there was another draft that we were going on now to actually start flying training.
Yeah.
I don't remember very much. No, I'm sorry. I've misled you here. No, I've misled you. Brandon was a manning depot. I'm sorry. Brandon was not an initial training school. Brandon was a manning depot. Yes. And then we went to Regina from Brandon to what we call the initial training school.
Right.
And that is where, yes, that is where we began to get some instruction in airmanship, as well as administration and law. In other words, that is where we were not only being drilled, continuation of drill and rifle work and so forth, but we were attending lectures. So that was the beginning of ground school, if you will. I forgot about that. And gosh, I know why I suddenly remembered it, because, again, in Regina, I met a family, and he was the inspector for the Bank of Commerce for the province. And I can remember there were two beautiful gals in that family, and so I had a great time swearing these gals around while I was there in Regina, which was great. But again, we were in the Regina Horticultural Halls, or whatever it was, or
still at that time.
Oh, very much so. Yes, very much so. We were not in anything permanent in Regina. And Regina in those days was not very big, too. I can't remember what Regina was, but I would think, what, perhaps 35,000, something like that? Somewhere around there. I know it wasn't very big. And I don't remember very much of Regina, because we were not there very long, because that training was pretty short and sharp, and then off to Saskatoon. Now, I guess I'd better... Let me just check a date here, because I want to make... Yes, it was from Regina. It was from Regina to Saskatoon. Going to Saskatoon. That's right, where I spent my 21st birthday. In other words, the 4th of January, 1921, I spent on a train going from Regina to Saskatoon. It wasn't a very long trip, but nevertheless, it was on the train, and I remember celebrating it with, there were about four of us. It was another draft movement, and I remember we had a bottle of rye, and that was a celebration for my 21st birthday.
Right.
It was an overnight trip. And then to Saskatoon, and I've gone over Saskatoon, which was great guard work, terrible, just cold, and it was later in the winter. See, we're now into January, January, February, and it was bitterly cold. And then, I just checked my logbook. My first flight was on February the 10th of 1941. So it would be somewhere about the end of January, or very early February, when I went from Saskatoon to Vancouver, because the initial EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School, that I attended, went to, was at Vancouver.
You went from Saskatoon then...
To Regina. No, sorry, from Saskatoon on guard duty back to Vancouver, to EFTS.
Oh, I see. I thought you'd be happy to get back to the West Coast,
yes.
I would think.
After that winter? Oh, my God, yes. Out there in that cold. I had never experienced cold like that. I'd never seen cold. I'd never seen snow like that, and blizzards. When that wind got whipping around, and there you were, God, we even built fires. Literally, we'd scrounge any piece of scrap wood or anything like that to get a fire going outside your sentry box, so to speak, to try and get warm.
Yeah.
Oh, it was miserable. Yeah. Miserable. And frostbite all over the place. It was stupid. However, it was the system, and I suppose there it was. We all survived.
Well, now, in Vancouver, where would you be, where would your barracks, or where would you be stationed there?
Vancouver, they had built the buildings, the barracks, and the hangars at Sea Island, the present airport.
Yeah.
And the EFTS, I can even give the number on it, because it's very easy to do. Jesus, wouldn't you know? Yes, here we are. Number eight, Elementary Flying Training School. Sea Island.
Yeah.
God, they used to call it Eburn in those days.
Eburn.
That's the old name. Yeah. Yeah, Eburn. Yeah. I see it here in the stamp. And then, of course, Tiger Moss.
Mm-hmm. That's the first plane I ever played around in.
Is that right?
My father flew them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, my first flight, first time I was up in an airplane, was on February the 10th. And I see that it was sequences 1, 1A, 2, and 3, and it was for 30 minutes. And my instructor was H.A. Harris, who was an American, a civilian.
Yeah.
He was one of those Americans who had come up to man one of the elementary flying schools. And it was number 4075 was the number of the old Tiger Moth. then it went on, and... I see Walmsley was a secretary. My God, I'd forgotten. Yes, they even had secretaries who used to keep the log books and so forth. And I didn't... he had to sign the book and confirm the time and so forth. And I see Pogue, who I don't know what had happened to, P-O-A-G, was the flight lieutenant. And he was the chief supervisory officer at number eight.
You'd be divided, what, into sort of platoons, classes, sections, or what?
We were then, I guess we would, by that time we would be in flights. And again, I honestly can't remember, because it was not a big school.
No.
Not a big school at all. I can't even remember how many birds we had, but I'm guessing. I would be surprised. I would be surprised if we had more than 15 or 20
aircraft
at the school at that time.
Well, tell me, Raj, you know, in view of your later life, this is the first time you go up in the air. What did you think about it?
Oh, I was frightened to death. God, yes. Oh, yes. God, I talk about an elevator going up and down. You know, even a dear old Tiger Moth, I was beginning to wonder whether I'd made the right decision there or not. And then when he said, well, and of course, you start taking the controls and start to fly this thing. And we had, of course, ground school as well.
Yeah.
So
did you have the link trainer?
The link came on a little later. The link?
Probably would, yes.
Wait a minute. March. No, by golly, we had link. Yes, we did. I had my first link on March the 4th. And on March the 4th, I was still at EFTS.
Mm-hmm.
So we did start the link. But the link came in. I can see I did link almost every day for the month of March to complete the full sequence
mm-hmm.
that was required. They required 8 hours and 30 minutes of link to get through the course.
Well, in a word, and remember you're talking to an old Army man, how do you learn to fly?
Well, I suppose, of course, when you look back at it, it's very simple to learn how to fly. Gosh, it's... like any other vehicle or form of conveyance, or driving a car, Once you know what that stick is for, in the same way as you know what the steering wheel is for, and you know what a throttle is for, in the same way as you know what a throttle is for, the difference, and I suppose you could compare the, not with the Tiger Moth, but with the later airplanes, you could compare the gear shift to the pitch control, which controls sort of the speed of the propeller. Mm-hmm. With that, it was then just a question of what the hell does that stick do, and the various movements of that stick to do the various things, and then combining that with your rudder control, the combination of the two. And it is actually quite simple. The difficult part, if there is one, is in coming into land, is what they call the holding off, knowing, being able to have that depth perception so that you hold off the airplane at the right height. And you don't fly it into the ground, or you don't drop it from 10 or 15 feet. Mm-hmm. And that does take a little bit of practice. There's no question about it. Yeah. You just watch anybody the first time, that first few circuits and landings. Yeah. Sometimes they fly it right in, and then they bounce high, and they have to go around, because you're taught all those emergency drills immediately.
Yeah.
Almost before you start to fly, the first thing you do. Matter of fact, 2 and 3, some of those were straight emergency measures. For example, engine failure. What do you do if you have an engine failure? They tell you right away, because you're going to be going solo,
yeah,
very soon, and therefore you've got to know what to do if these emergencies happen quickly. And so that was one of the first things they did, was teach you the emergency. Engine failure was the most important, of course, and particularly in a little plane like the Tiger Moth. And the other one, of course, an overshoot. What to do if you do have a bad landing. You fly it in the ground and you bounce.
Mm-hmm.
You don't try and do a second landing. You open everything up and go around again, but you've got to open up quite quickly. You've got to make your decision and go, otherwise you're going to stall.
Yeah.
And if you try and do a second landing, you're the whole airplane is not in the right posture for another attempt at landing. So you've got to go around. So those were the two most important things: engine failure and an overshoot.
In this period, did you have any rather interesting experiences yourself?
I not in terms of emergencies, but one of the things we had to do when I went solo, I went solo on the 3rd of March, and by that time, how many hours I had? 10, 11. I had 11. I had 9 hours. No, 10 hours. That's right. 10 hours. That's right. You did 10 hours flying, and boy, then you were solo. And you did 10 hours, and if you had done all the right sequences in those 10 hours, then I see the instructor took you up and said, okay, this is it. And he just to take you up and just to get you calmed down in the air. And he said, 10 minutes with the instructor, do a landing. And just to make sure, he wanted to be satisfied that you were mentally up to go solo. And I remember then he landed, and he just climbed out of the airplane, and he said, okay, away you go. And that's how it was. Actually, it was 10 hours and 10 minutes, and I was solo in the Tiger Moth. But a little later on, I had to do a cross-country.
Oh, yeah.
Which was part of the flying. I see I had a 20-hour test here. Which was given by one of the flying officer Roberts, and this was a halfway through the course check to make sure that you were still doing all right.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't remember any of it. It was just straightforward aerobatics, simple aerobatics. But the cross country, here I am, cross country. No, that's not one. I did one up the Fraser. We were to go up. I guess I was to go to Hope. And it was quite a nice day, and I got up the river, the Fraser, and I thought, my God, the country up there is so lovely. I think I'll just do a little sightseeing. So I started to fly up a valley, and as happened, all of a sudden, the valley came to an end, and there I was, still heading into solid rock. And the valley was getting narrower and narrower, and of course, this is where, thank goodness, the aerobatic training really saved me from praying. Because you just pull her up and do a wing over, which is the only way you can do a fast turn. And I just pulled the nose up and did a wing over and got the hell out of that place. And with my heart pounding pretty hard, because it got very rough, too. I got into those air currents that were in there. And I was up and down like the proverbial being bounced around in that little damn thing. And I wasn't too sure I was going to get out of there. I scared myself.
Yeah.
And I learned a lesson. Not to go charging off on cross countries or up places unless you know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
So that, I think, was probably the only thing that I can remember in the way of scaring myself or anything like that. I did, though, have a bad case of tonsillitis while I was there. And the... yes, here it is. I must have had it 21st, 23rd, because I know that I suddenly had to do an awful lot of fly in a very few days to finish the course. For example, I have here on the 28th, on the 28th of March, let's see, I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times I was airborne in that one day. And I put in on the 28th, I put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 440, 440, 5, 6, I put in about 8 hours flying in that one day. I had to do it to get, the course had gone ahead of me.
Yeah.
And part of that was my 50-hour test. And the idea was 50 hours, and I put in 50 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But on that last day, that was an awful lot of fun, and I can remember, God, I was tired at the end of that day.
Yeah, there used to be the time when it was just physical.
That's right. And there was a lot of aerobatics in that. I had to do all sorts of sequences in that one day to complete the training program.
Were there, in the class that you were going through, were there any accidents, or were there...
Can't remember. Yeah. No, not there.
Any particular humorous incidents that you remember during that period?
No. I don't remember anything other than the fact that it was very concentrated, because from the 10th of February to the 28th of March, we did 50 hours of flying, and an awful lot of ground school, and nearly 10 hours of length training.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even remember after hours activities. I think we were in the books. We were studying quite hard.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fair amount of night work. The social aspect of Vancouver is an absolute blank. I don't think there was any. Partly because I had that bloody tonsillitis which knocked me out for over a week, and I had a lot to catch up.
Yeah.
And so there it was. No, it was. Straightforward flying. I can remember my instructor, who, by the way, later joined the RCF one of those terrible things that happens. I saw his name come up on the board at 6th Group when I was then group captain in Air 1, and I checked, and sure enough, it was my instructor, and bingo, he went missing that night. I never knew what happened to him. I never saw him, but they just saw his name up on the board, and that was it. Gone the next day.
Yep.
Chopped down.
Well, now, at the end of your elementary trial...
Elementary training.
Yeah,
school. Flying training school.
Is that when you would get your wings?
No. All that did was really, as I say, you put 50 hours in, of which a lot of, there were various sequences that you went through. You were really perfecting your flying. You were really learning aerobatics was as much as anything. Aerobatics and becoming just smooth as a pilot. From there, you went to SFTS. Which was a senior flying training school, and I went there. I finished it on the 28th of March, and on April the 16th, I had my first flight in Harvard at Dauphin, because I went to 10 SFTS Dauphin, Manitoba.
Oh, Dauphin,
Manitoba.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were the second course into Dauphin, because the roads hadn't even been laid. And by April, the spring thaw, and good prairie gumbo mud. And the roads were just unbelievable. It was wet, and you'd wear your flying boots, and you'd wind up with that usual great big clod of mud around your flying boots. It was terrible. But, of course, by the time we finished, they'd gotten the roads down. Oh, and the other thing, too, because you became an LAC when you went to a leading aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
You've gone through being an AC-2 and an AC-1 at the end of your, I guess we went to AC-1 after our initial training school, mm-hmm. and you're an AC-1 while you're at EFTS, and then when you finished EFTS, you become an LAC.
Leading aircraft.
That's right. Yeah. And you wore the white little thing in your cap, the fore and aft cap, which had a little white, just a white flash, which meant your air crew training. Air crew. Yeah, well, for the Air Force, it was air crew training.
Uh-huh.
But you were an LAC, and you wore the airplane on your arm.
Yeah.
And but it was the white flash that indicated that you were under training. You were UT air crew. And Harvard, at Dauphin, was when we really got down to it. Because now let me just look at this very quickly. 1 hour 5, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. 5 hours of dual on the Harvard. And it was the same thing, primarily learning the emergency procedures. What happens if you have an engine failure? Because now you're in an airplane that's going to fall out of the sky. It's not going to glide like the old Tiger Moth would, an all-metal airplane. Engine failure, and again, overshoot procedures. And in this one, of course, it was even more important that you had to make your mind up much more quickly. If you were going to overshoot, you had to do it, because you're going to stall much more quickly.
Yeah, but there's certain peculiarities about the Harvard, weren't there?
Oh, yes, it had a terrible torque on it. It'd swing all over the bloody place. And a good part of that 5 hours was spent literally going down that bloody runway, slowly opening up the power to get the feel for that terrific swing. You always wanted to, can't remember whether it was to the left or the right, but swing off the runway.
Yeah.
And, of course, the only way you had to stop that was probably, well, you had a bit of brake, but the brakes were ineffective. We're not terribly efficient. A bit of brake, but primarily with rudder control. So you had to get the airflow going fast enough over your rudder, and you didn't want to get a rudder stall. You had to let the airflow over the rudders build up before you started to apply too much rudder. Otherwise, you had a sort of a tumbling over of the airfoil, and of course your rudders were ineffective. Mm-hmm. That was when you really had a ground, what we call a ground spin. So that the 5 hours, and then that was it. Boy, you were solo, and away you went. You were on your own. But of course, with instructors taking you up every once in a while to check you on different sequences, and gradually bringing you along, perfecting aerobatics, doing cross countries. But now you're into navigation. In other words, you would have to plan your cross country properly, not like I did at Sea Island, where I just went up and flew visually with a VFR type of thing. With just a map, and sort of go there and back again, type of thing. Here, your cross countries had to be planned, and you had to have your map, you had to work out as you did with a computer. We had the forecast winds given to you. In other words, it was a proper navigation exercise.
Well, now, the fact that you were in Harvard, did this give any indication as to what you would eventually be with respect to, shall we say, fighter, bomber?
No. At that time, most people who were going through on Harvard were fighters, training to be fighter pilots.
Yeah.
Because they did have the Ensigns, and what was the other twin-engine bird they had? I can't remember the name of it. And they had those twin-engine schools, and people were going through, I suppose, to be, but perhaps, not necessarily bombers, because there was a lot of coastal, too, coastal command, Let's say multi-engine, as opposed to single-engine. Most of the Harvard people were going to be fighter pilots. And, of course, at that time of the war, there was a great need for fighter pilots.
Yeah.
We're sort of getting Battle of Britain building up to that time.
Yeah.
And hence...
If that's over, I mean, you'd have the losses from the Battle of Britain by that
time. Yes, that's right. So there was a need to build up fighter command.
Yeah.
So to all intents and purposes, you were still really being streamed now as a fighter pilot, not a bomber pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the SFTS is a lot to, I think, a lot to talk about with the SFTS.
Yeah,
and it's now 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I think we should break up.
And if you don't mind, because I've got a golf game at 12. And,
right.
If we could stop here and I could pick it up with the SFTS, because it really is, that now it's beginning to get to, I suppose, what you'd call the the real beginning of the pilot training and what happened there is a lot.